Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay. So the sutta today is quite a simple sutta. It's quite short, and there isn't that much in there. But the reason I chose this sutta was because I wanted to choose something that I thought nobody had done for a long time. So I don't actually know what's happened before, so I just chose a sutta which I thought was unlikely to have been done before. And the good thing about choosing a simple sutta is that it gives an opportunity to go into quite a bit of depth on some of the points on the sutta, which is quite nice. So even though it looks simple, there's always more to this thing than meets the eye, as usual. So there is this opportunity to have maybe a little bit more, spend a little bit more time going into some more details. Because the actual reading itself is only about 5, 4.5 pages, basically. Okay, so this is Majjhima number 57, the Kukkura Vatika Sutta, the Dog Duty Ascetic. Dog Duty Ascetic is an ascetic who practices a dog vow. He vows to behave like a dog, basically. This is what it means to do the dog duty. So that's the ascetic which behaves like a dog. Okay. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Kalyan country, where there was a town of the Kalyans named Halidavasana. Then Punna, son of the Kalyans, an ox duty ascetic, and also Senya, a naked dog duty ascetic, went to the Blessed One. It's interesting here that you have this kind of ascetics, ox duty ascetic and a naked dog duty ascetic. It's quite remarkable. I think it shows you a bit about India and about what India was like in those days. And apparently still is to this day. They have all these strange wanderers, all these strange ascetics, and all these weird religions, and people doing all kinds of strange stuff to get somewhere in life, to actually do something positive. And I remember actually Venerable Bodhi, the translator of this book, he mentioned during one of his discourses that when he went to India, he saw this type of ascetic in India. So it still exists today after 2,500 years. So India is like a very religious country with this vast number of different religions and people doing all kinds of strange practices. Ainsley, did you live in India? So did you see any of these things happening? Yeah, yeah. Which part of India did you live in? The north. Okay. Yeah. Right. Do you ever see a dog duty ascetic? No. Okay, it's just as well probably. Okay, so Punna, the ox duty ascetic, paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side, while Senya, the naked dog duty ascetic, exchanged greetings with the Blessed One. And when this courteous, amiable talk was finished, he too sat down at one side, curled up like a dog. Oh dear. Punna, the ox duty ascetic, said to the Blessed One. Before I go on, I just want to maybe point out here, it's quite how actually it's interesting that the ox duty ascetic paid homage to the Blessed One. Even though he was from a different religion in a sense, in a different tradition, he actually paid homage to the Buddha. So this shows you that there was obviously a lot of mutual respect between these religions. And people actually even had enough respect between ascetics that they actually paid homage to each other, which is quite fascinating. In the world today, you see so much arguments between religions, but here you actually see a kind of harmony between religions. That is one possible explanation for that. Another possible explanation is that, and this is actually an interesting point in terms of how to read the suttas, and a possible explanation is that this part, which is like an introductory part, it's like a narrative part of the sutta, may actually not be, it's not a core part of the sutta. The core part of the sutta comes afterwards when the Buddha speaks and it tells you about the Dhamma. But this is a narrative introduction. And the narrative introduction is often much less true to history than the actual sutta part itself. So when you compare, for example, some of the suttas with the Chinese, you will see that the narrative part of it will be different in the Chinese than it is in the Pali. So you have to conclude that it's less historical, it's less certain that this is actually what happened. So both the introduction and the conclusion, which often is narrative, is less certain than the actual Dhamma itself. Okay, so Puna, the ox duty ascetic, said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, this Senya is a naked dog duty ascetic who does what is hard to do. He eats his food when it is thrown to the ground. He has long taken up and practiced that dog duty. What will be his destination? What will be his future course?" Okay, the Pali here for destination and future course. Destination is gati, literally means going. It is always refers to future life. This is what it means. And the same thing with future course. Abhisamparaya is also a word for future life. It's the opposite of the present life, if you like. So this is an important point that we're actually talking about future lives here. And the Buddha answers, "Enough, Puna. Let that be. Do not ask me that." A second time and a third time, Puna, the ox-duty ascetic, said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, this Senya is a naked dog-duty ascetic who does what is hard to do. He eats his food when it is thrown to the ground. He has long taken up and practiced that dog-duty. What will be his destination? What will be his future course?" "Well, Puna, since I certainly cannot persuade you when I say, 'Enough, Puna, let that be, do not ask me that,' I shall therefore answer you. Here, Puna, someone develops the dog duty fully and uninterruptedly. He develops the dog habit fully and uninterruptedly. He develops the dog mind fully and uninterruptedly. He develops dog behavior fully and uninterruptedly. Having done so, on the dissolution of the body, after death, he reappears in the company of dogs. But if he has such a view as this, by this virtue or observance or asceticism or holy life, I shall become a great god or some lesser god, that is wrong view in this case. Now, there are two destinations for one with wrong view, I say, hell or the animal realm. So, Puna, if his dog duty succeeds, it will lead him to the company of dogs. If it fails, it will lead him to hell." That's pretty stark and pretty serious warning there from the Buddha. Okay, I'm going to go through this paragraph now in a little bit more detail to just discuss some of the things here. If anybody has any questions as we go along, please just please say so. We can take them as we go along because it's a reasonably short sutta here. I think it's pretty much the same. That's an actually interesting point. That very often the reason they say things not only twice but often have like strings of synonyms in the Pali. And the, one of the reasons for that is because it's an oral tradition. So because it is an oral tradition, they often put a lot of strings or synonyms together to make it easy to remember what's going on. So very often it doesn't actually have any significance in its own right. It's just because it's easy to recall things. Okay. So he develops this dog duty, and he develops the dog mind, it says here on page 493 on the bottom, fully and uninterruptedly. So the most important one of these developments here is actually the development of the dog mind. You can say that the development of the dog habit and the development of the dog behavior, that these are like supports for developing the dog mind. The most important one here is the development of the dog mind. Because if you do develop the dog mind fully, then in a sense you become like a dog. You think like a dog. You are trying. You're basically trying to be a dog to the utmost. And of course, if you become like a dog in this life, if you start thinking like a dog and you go around even barking on all fours and eat from the ground, then of course your mind will incline towards being a dog. And you will have a sense inside of yourself that you are a dog already here. And of course, then when you get reborn, if your mind already is like a dog, and the moment you get reborn, that mind is going to incline to becoming a dog and to being a dog. And this is a very powerful, it shows you very powerfully how the law of karma actually works. Because there's one thing which goes on from life to life, and that is obviously the mind. And that mind state that you have generally in this life is going to be the mind state that you take with you into your next life. So if you have a dog mind state, you're going to take that dog mind state into next life, and you get reborn as a dog. If you have a dark mind state because you've done a lot of bad karma, then you're going to bring that darkness with you into your next life, and you're going to go to an according realm. And this is it shows you the basic principle of karma, that the mind state you have now is what you bring with you in the future. And of course, you get the corresponding rebirth. I think it's just that people had this strange idea, is that, I don't know, it doesn't say anywhere why he did it. It was just a type of practice, basically, that they did. And that somebody said, if you do this, you will go to heaven. And he believed that, so he practiced accordingly. Yeah. It comes up afterwards. Yeah. I'll come to that in a second. I'm just moving on to that. Okay, so because he has developed the dog mind, well, then the destination is to reappear in the company of dogs. Reappearing in the company of dogs is basically another way of saying becoming a dog. And then the Buddha said, but if he has a wrong view that by this observance or asceticism or holy life or virtue, I shall become a god, then it's even more severe. Now, it is important here to realize what wrong view actually means in this particular case. Because the Buddha says that for someone with wrong view, there's only two destinations, the hell or the animal realm. But if you look at this particular type of wrong view, you will see that it's a very specific type of wrong view. It's a wrong view about karma and rebirth. The karma is the action you do now, is this observance, this virtue of being a dog. That's the karma you're making here. And by virtue of that karma, you think that you will get reborn as a god. So basically, you have a wrong view about karma and rebirth. And if you read the suttas, you will see that when the Buddha talks about wrong view, this is the most important aspect of wrong view, is the lack of belief in karma and rebirth, and the effect of karma has on your rebirth. So if you deny, if you say, I don't... bad actions don't lead to a bad rebirth, then that is already a bad karma, and it takes you in the wrong direction. And then if you act upon that when it becomes really serious, because if you act upon that view, it means that you do whatever you want without regard for whether it is good or bad, because you think it doesn't have any kind of consequences in the future. So it becomes pretty serious. So this is what wrong view means here. It means wrong view about karma and rebirth. You either don't believe in rebirth, or you don't believe that what you do, how you act, has any effect on rebirth. And then he says, now there are two destinations for one with wrong view, I say, hell or the animal realm. Now, to understand this, why wrong view should have such a severe consequence, basically the point here is that wrong view is a kind of delusion, right? You think that doing bad acts doesn't have any consequences. You think that doing good acts doesn't have any consequences. But it's a delusion of the mind. It's not actually understanding that goodness and badness has consequences. And I think most of you, we all realize that usually there is consequences of good and bad acts. It's just you can see that in your own mind. When you do something good, you do something bad, something happens in there. You feel good and you feel bad accordingly. But somebody who is so deluded that they can't see that, and they have no faith either that this is actually the case, they will tend to get reborn in a place where beings are deluded. And the typical place where beings are deluded is the animal realm, because animals don't have any understanding of how things work, don't have any understanding of cause and effect. Sometimes I see the kangaroos in the monastery, I'm just amazed how stupid they can be sometimes. I pour the food out on the ground in one place, and they go sniffing somewhere else, thinking the food is somewhere else. And you feel a bit sorry for them, because sometimes they are so clueless. But after a while, they get it. But basically, they don't understand cause and effect. They don't understand how things work. Essentially, they're just deluded. And this is one of the main aspects of the animal realm, is this delusion or ignorance and stupidity. And that's why if you tend to be deluded in this life, you got wrong view, you don't understand the severity of bad actions, you don't understand the potential of good actions, then you will tend to go to a realm which is according to that, which is the animal realm, basically. So this is how you can see how wrong view tends to lead to the animal realm. And then the other possibility is that it goes to hell. Now, it doesn't say this here, but I suspect that the reason why it goes to hell is because if you really have wrong view, you will tend to act according to that wrong view. So you will tend to do bad actions, thinking it doesn't matter anyway. You will avoid doing good actions because there's no point in doing good actions. So because of that, you are both having wrong view and you're also acting accordingly. And if you act accordingly in a bad way, that's obviously when you will tend to go to hell. Because hell is basically just doing bad actions, bad actions, bad actions all the time, building up enormous amount of bad karma. And then the results are obviously very severe after a while. Basically, you're making a very dark mind for yourself, and the dark mind cannot go to a bright place. It's really as simple as that. Okay, so these are the two destinations for wrong view. So, Puna, if his dog duty succeeds, it will lead him to the company of dogs. If it fails, it will lead him to hell. So, dog duty succeeding means that you are able to develop the dog mind, and if you become like a dog inside, if you're able to become like a dog inside, then you become reborn as a dog. That's what succeeding means in this particular case. If you don't succeed, and that can mean two things. It can mean either that you are not able to develop that dog mind properly, in which case you don't succeed, or it can also mean that you do so much bad karma on the way that you are no longer able to get reborn as a dog. Remember that getting reborn as a dog is a higher kind of rebirth than getting reborn in hell. So if you do a lot of bad karma and you want to become a dog, but your karma is so bad that it doesn't allow you to become a dog, then you might go to hell instead. So these are the two ways that it doesn't succeed, in the sense that it is not able to develop the dog mind properly, or he just makes so much bad karma that you can't even get reborn as a dog because your karma is so bad. And you can imagine if you really are going to be like a dog, you might go around biting people, you might go around doing all kinds of terrible things, you know. So you make a lot of bad karma. Okay, so I move on to the next paragraph. Paragraph 4, page 494. When this was said, Sainya, the naked dog duty ascetic, cried out and burst into tears. Then the Blessed One told Puna, son of the Kalyans, the ox duty ascetic, Puna, I could not persuade you when I said, enough, Puna, let that be, do not ask me that. Then Sainya, the naked dog duty ascetic, said, Venerable Sir, I am not crying because the Blessed One has said this about me here, but because I have taken up and practiced this dog duty. I have long taken up and practiced this dog duty here. Venerable Sir, this Puna, son of the Kalyans, is an ox duty ascetic. He has long taken up and practiced that ox duty here. What will be his destination? What will be his future course? Okay, so now we're basically repeating ourselves a little bit. Enough, Sainya, let that be, do not ask me that. A second time and a third time, Sainya, the naked dog duty ascetic, asked the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, this Puna, son of the Kalyans, is an ox duty ascetic. He has long taken up and practiced that ox duty. What will be his destination? What will be his future course? Well, Senya, since I certainly cannot persuade you, when I say, enough, Senya, let that be, do not ask me that, I shall therefore answer you. Here, Senya, someone develops the ox duty fully and uninterruptedly. He develops the ox habit fully and uninterruptedly. He develops the ox mind fully and uninterruptedly. He develops ox behavior fully and uninterruptedly. Having done so, on the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in the company of oxen. But if he has such a view as this, by this virtue or observance or asceticism or holy life, I shall become a great god or some lesser god, that is wrong view in his case. Now, there are two destinations for one with wrong view. I say, hell or the animal realm. So, Senya, if his ox duty succeeds, it will lead him to the company of oxen. If it fails, it will lead him to hell. When this was said, Puna, son of the Kalyans, the ox duty ascetic, cried out and burst into tears. Then the Blessed One told Senya, the naked dog duty ascetic, Senya, I could not persuade you when I said, enough, Senya, let that be, do not ask me that. Then Puna, the ox duty ascetic, said, Venerable Sir, I am not crying out, because the Blessed One has said this about me, but because I have long taken up and practiced this ox duty. In other words, he feels he has wasted his time for nothing, presumably. So he's crying because he's doing this for a long time, for not only for no benefit, for negative benefit, if you like. But then he says, Venerable Sir, I have confidence in the Blessed One thus. The Blessed One is capable of teaching me the Dhamma in such a way that I can abandon this ox duty, and that this Senya, the naked dog duty ascetic, can abandon that dog duty. So now he wants the Buddha to convince him that the dog duty and the ox duty are useless, and they should go on to another path. That's what basically he's asking the Buddha to do here. Okay. Then Puna, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, he replied. The Blessed One said this. Puna, there are four kinds of action proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. What are the four? There is dark action with dark result. There is bright action with bright result. There is dark and bright action with dark and bright result. There is action that is neither dark nor bright with neither dark nor bright result. Action that leads to the destruction of action. Okay. The first thing to note in this paragraph, and this is actually, I find this very important. In the very first sentence there, the Buddha says, there are four kinds of action proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. Realizing them for myself is the Pali word is called sacchikaroti, which literally means, it's derived from the word aki, which is I, and karoti is to do, and sa means own, so it means doing with one's own eye. In other words, seeing with your own eye, that's what it means. So it quite literally means realize. So what the Buddha is saying here, he has seen it with his own eye, these particular four types of action. And then with direct knowledge has a similar kind of connotation. Direct knowledge is that you actually experience this for yourself. That's what direct knowledge means. You're there and you see these things for yourself. And this is very important because sometimes if you read Buddhist books, and you have to be very careful when you read Buddhist books, because there's often a lot of strange things written in Buddhist books. And one of the things that you sometimes read, and particularly maybe some years ago, is sometimes you read that the Buddha accepted the world view in India at the time that there was such a thing as rebirth and that there was karma. Sometimes you read that. But if you really know your Buddhist text well, you realize that the Buddha, one very important aspect of his enlightenment, on his enlightenment night, was precisely the realization of rebirth and karma. This is what he realized. If you remember the story as it goes, it's in the Majjhima 36, just a few suttas before this, the Buddha sat down under the Bodhi tree. He practiced the jhanas, the deep states of meditation. After coming out of those jhanas, the first thing that he did was to recall his past lives. That's the first thing he did. And remember that this was one of his main insights on that night of enlightenment. It's very, very important. It's a very important part of what he understood. The second thing he realized was the laws of karma. Again, a very important part. And only when he had seen those two things and he realized how terrible this samsara was, that you just go around and around, you do the same thing again and again and again. You go up, then you go down, you go to this realm and that realm. He realized how completely, utterly meaningless it was, and how what a waste of time it was to just go around like this. Then he got this sense of, I want to get out of this. I don't want to be part of this anymore. This is just suffering, again and again and again. And only then, when he had understood that, did his full enlightenment occur. So the realization of rebirth and karma is an integral part of the Buddha's awakening here. Without it, it's not really Buddhism in the same way here. And that is very important to understand. And it's also very much part of what you might call the Buddhist idea of investigating for yourself. The idea that the Buddha should just have accepted something because it was accepted in society at large doesn't square very well with the general Buddhist idea of investigating for yourself. You know, and this, of course, is what the Buddha did. He investigated for himself. He found out there is such a thing as rebirth. And only then did he actually teach it and did he use it for his own enlightenment experience. So that, for me at least, that's very important because sometimes you can read, as I said, strange things when you read books on Buddhism. And fair enough, I mean, many of these books were written some decades ago and people still had less understanding of Buddhism. So obviously they were going to make some mistakes. And I'm sure in a few decades from now people are going to look back at us and say they didn't understand much of Buddhism at all. So things develop basically. So that's just the way it is. Okay, then we come to the four types of action. In other words, now we're talking about karma. Bright action leading to bright results, etc. This is the law of karma here we're talking about. And having just outlined the four types of action, the Buddha then goes on to explain these four types in much more detail there. So, the first one is the dark with dark results. And what, Puna, is dark action with dark results? Here, someone generates an afflictive bodily formation, an afflictive verbal formation, and an afflictive mental formation. Okay, I don't know if anybody of you understands. You probably have a rough idea what this means, but the English is not easy to understand, I must say. It's not very clear what is actually meant here. An afflictive, or afflictive is probably clear enough, and bodily is clear, but this word formation is a strange word. The way I have translated this, now, where did I? A way of looking at this, which is probably much more useful, is that the Buddha he generates a intention through the body, which is hurtful. That's probably an easy way of understanding this. So you generate an intention through the body, which is hurtful. That's basically what it means. Formation here, this word actually is more like intention. That is the important aspect of that particular word. And then he generates an intention through the mouth or verbally that is hurtful to others. Then he generates an afflictive intention through the mind. That's the last one, which is hurtful. Having generated an intention through the body, which is hurtful, an intention through verbally, which is hurtful, an intention through the mind, which is hurtful, he reappears in a hurtful world. When he has reappeared in a hurtful world, hurtful contacts touch him. Being touched by hurtful contacts, he feels hurtful feelings, exclusively painful, as in the case of beings in hell. Thus, a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed. When one has reappeared, contacts touch one. Thus, I say, beings are heirs of their actions. This is called dark action with dark result. Okay. So basically, what a dark action is here, and this is the important point, is an action which is basically an intention which is unwholesome and completely unwholesome. This is not a mixed action which has a little bit of wholesomeness or a little bit of unwholesomeness. This is a purely unwholesome intention. An unwholesome intention is one which is done with an unwholesome mind state, right? So your motivation is unwholesome. You're motivated by anger. You're motivated by greed. Or you are completely deluded. You don't know what's going on. So that is an unwholesome motivation here. And this is a one-sided motivation, which is only and just unwholesome. And there are many ways you can look at this. For example, if the five hindrances are present in the mind, and you act fully and completely out of the five hindrances, then that will be a dark action. It won't have any. It will be completely dark because of that. So here we're talking about something which is one-sidedly dark. It doesn't have any kind of redeeming qualities to it. It's just out of anger, just out of greed, particularly out of anger. So when you do that sort of action, that action in itself will tend to bring you to a lower state. So obviously one action in its own right is not going to take you to a lower state. It can do, but usually it won't. It's when you do this repeatedly again and again and again that it will tend to drag you down. And then, of course, when you do lots of dark actions, it's actually a very good metaphor, this idea of dark action. Because what it does, it darkens the mind. If you think in your own life, you think about what happens if you do something bad. I'm sure we've all done occasionally things that we regret. And it gives this negative sense in the mind, a kind of darkness in the mind. It clouds the mind. And when you go back and you think about it, you don't feel good about it. And the bad thing is that it has a cumulative effect. So the more of this you do, slowly but surely the mind gets darker and darker and darker. And of course, when the mind is really dark, then you cannot get reborn in heaven, because a heavenly realm is a place where people have bright minds, with a happy mind. So you cannot go to a place where people have happy minds when you have a dark mind. It just doesn't work, because the whole point of heaven is to have a happy mind. So you will go, because of the darkness of the mind will go towards the realm which is has a similar quality to your mind state. And this is karma, then leading to rebirth accordingly. So dark actions will darken your mind and take you to a dark realm. This is what basically was what it's saying here. And if the mind is dark enough, then you will have exclusively painful feelings, as in the case of beings in hell. Beings in hell, apparently, they can feel pain almost continuously. Thus, a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed. Now, this sentence, one has to be a little bit careful in understanding this sentence, because sometimes I hear people have this idea in Buddhism that, well, somebody else did all the bad actions, and somebody else is going to get reborn to experience those actions. It won't actually be me, it will be somebody else. And this here sounds a bit like that. Sounds like, well, somebody else is going to experience the bad results, so it doesn't matter so much. But the point here is not so much that somebody else is experiencing the action. The point here is more that those actions were done in the past. They have been done, and the result is going to have to be experienced. Because when you get reborn, it's not as if it's a different being which is there. It's still you. It's just the continuity of the mind. It's just like in this life, if you consider yourself in this life, you can see the continuity from you were a small child until now. And you will say, it's the same person, right? Same person going all the way through. But at the same time, you also know that it's a different person at the same time. You have developed and evolved over that lifetime. And in exactly the same way, when you get reborn, it's your own mind which continues. So if you can recall your past life, you will say, oh yeah, that was me there in the past life. If you recall life before that, you will say, oh yeah, that was me again before that. But there will also be change and evolution, just like there is in this life. So it's not as if there is a different being there. It is the same being, the same mind which continues. So don't fall into that trap, which I sometimes hear people fall into. And then, of course, one reaps the results of those bad actions. When you go to a dark realm, you go to a realm which is painful. And you become heir to those dark actions that you did in the past life. This is called dark action with dark results. And what puna, paragraph 9, what puna is bright action with bright result. Here someone generates an unafflictive bodily formation. In other words, they intend through the body something which is not hurtful, or very often the opposite, something which is kind, something which is beneficial to others. They intend through the verbally something which is kind. They intend through the mind something which is kind and non-hurtful. Having intended through the mind, through the body, and through verbally kind and unhurtful actions, he reappears in an unhurtful world, in a happy world. When he has reappeared in a happy world, happy contacts touch him. Being touched by pleasant contacts, he feels pleasant feelings, exclusively pleasant, as in the case of gods of refulgent glory. Okay. So in this case, the gods of refulgent glory, by the way, these are the gods of the third jhana realm. So because we are talking about here of gods of a very, very high stature, these gods, to be able to get reborn in the third jhana realm, you have to abandon the five hindrances. So because you have to abandon the five hindrances, the bright actions that we're talking about here are very, very bright actions. These are actions which are completely devoid of the five hindrances. So you have a completely pure mind. When you have a completely pure mind, you're incapable of doing harmful actions. There's no ill will there. There's no greed. There's nothing by which you could do a harmful action. So this is a very high state of purity. And that's why they're called bright actions with bright results. These are exclusively bright actions, the exact opposite of the exclusive dark actions we saw before. So they're not tinged with any kind of negative aspect. They're purely, purely good. Thus, a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed. When one has reappeared, contacts touch one. Thus, I say, beings are the heirs of their actions. This is called bright action with bright result. Yes? You don't have to die in third jhana, but you often what happens, well, it's a slightly gray area. You don't have to die in it, but if you can imagine if you have habituated the mind to the third jhana, when you die, then you will actually tend to go towards that third jhana. Because imagine when you die, you will tend to let go of things, right? The moment of death is always a time to let go of things. And you let go of things, then you might move in that direction. And then you get reborn in that realm because of that. It doesn't mean you have to get reborn. You have to die in the third jhana as such. Otherwise, you'd come to us. You have to ask somebody to stab you when you're in the third jhana. That wouldn't be very good, actually. Okay, so the next one, paragraph 10. And what puna is dark and bright action with dark and bright result? Here someone generates an intention through the body that is both hurtful and non-hurtful. Generate a body, a verbal intention that is both hurtful and non-hurtful. And they generate an intention through the mind that is both hurtful and non-hurtful. Having generated a bodily intention, a verbal intention, and a mental intention that is both hurtful and non-hurtful, he reappears in a world that is both hurtful and non-hurtful. When he has reappeared in a world that is both non-hurtful and hurtful, both hurtful and non-hurtful contacts touch him. Being touched by both hurtful and non-hurtful contacts, he feels both hurtful and non-hurtful feelings, mingled pleasure and pain, as in the case of human beings and some gods and some beings in the lower worlds. Thus, a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed. When one has reappeared, contacts touch one. Thus, I say, beings are heirs to their actions. This is called dark and bright action with dark and bright result. Okay, so here we have a mixture of actions. This is an action which is mixed. Now, I don't know if anyone you have read the sutta already, but in the back there's a note 607, and Venerable Bodhi, who's done the translate, well, actually, it's actually done by him and Venerable Nyanamoli, another monk. He says that in truth, there is no such thing as an action which is both hurtful and non-hurtful. Action is either one or the other, but you do a bit of both, is what he's saying here. But as a matter of fact, what this sutta is saying, it doesn't say that. This sutta actually says that the action is both hurtful and non-hurtful. And this idea that it has to be one or the other is a later idea. It comes from the Abhidhamma and the commentaries. It doesn't actually exist in the suttas. So when I read this, and I think that Venerable Bodhi in the back, when he puts in a note, he should say that this is an idea which is not from the suttas. This is from the Abhidhamma, because it helps you to clarify for you the importance of one statement versus another one. And I have, in my life as a monk, after many years of thinking about this, and of course being brainwashed by Ajahn Brahm and by others, you come to the conclusion after a while that the one thing which really matters at the end of the day here is the word of the Buddha. And why is it that the word of the Buddha is so important? Because the word, if it hadn't been for the Buddha, there wouldn't have been any Buddhism. So we have to assume that the Buddha was enlightened. If we cannot assume that the Buddha was enlightened, then this whole thing called Buddhism collapses. There's nothing left. So that is our basic assumption. We don't know the Buddha was enlightened. Maybe one day we will, because we will actually realize what he realized. We can't know it, but we have to assume it as long as we practice this path. But anything which wasn't written by the Buddha, we don't know where it is coming from. We don't know who has said this. We don't know whether they were arahants, whether they were sotapannas, whether they were putujanas, in other words, didn't have any experience of enlightenment. So we don't know where these words are coming from. Because we don't know where they're coming from, it means they can be right, but they can also be wrong. We just don't know. And because of that, I think it's always important to distinguish between the word of the Buddha and the word of other teachers and other monks and other people, including ancient monks like here, who probably wrote the Abhidhamma. So in this case, I would say that the note in the back, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. We just don't know. But what we should probably do is just to set it to one side, and we should say that if it was really important, the Buddha himself would have said so in the suttas. The fact that the Buddha didn't say so, and it was only said later on by other people, means that it cannot be that important. So even if it is right, we're not really missing out. And if it is wrong, well, we may actually have a wrong idea about things. This is the way I usually go about looking at the suttas and looking at later work to distinguish between what actually really is important, what is the core of the matter, and what is not. In this case, I would therefore say that it looks to me as if the Buddha is saying that there are such things as an act which is both hurtful and non-hurtful. And I would say that, you know, typical examples of these sort of acts would be when your intention is mixed up. And your intention might be, for example, the classic mixed intention is like the Robin Hood intention. You steal from a rich person to give to somebody who's poor, right? And often that sort of intention is even applauded in our society, because these rich people, they don't need money anyway. You might as well just give it to the poor. So we're just helping the rich and making some merit, so to speak. But of course, there is a bad intention there, because this theft in its own right is wrong. It's bad. But at the same time, you also have the motivation of giving to the poor. And that's what I understand as mixed afflictive and unafflictive intentions. And I think you will see that in the world, there's a lot of this going around. Take, for example, the war in Iraq. George Bush says, I want to free the Iraqis from oppression. And I guess we have to assume that that is true to some extent. I don't know. We don't know whether it's true, but presumably it is true. But at the same time, he also does it by killing somebody. He goes in to kill people at the same time. So it's like a mixed intention. There's some positive there, but there's also some bad. I think if you look inside yourself, you will find that very often this is the case. And in fact, if you haven't abandoned the hindrances fully, the five hindrances, and you are swayed by the hindrances to some extent, then there's going to be some bad intention there, mixed up with a good intention. So that's how you know, basically. How pure is your mind when you act? What are you acting out of? And that will give you some idea of how mixed it is and not. Well, I think the idea of the stick is more like there's different things which can give rise to rebirth in the future life. And it depends on your mind state, right? But generally speaking, it's your habitual actions which give rise to rebirth. And that's why you say you perfect the dog mind. You get the mind like a dog, you go to a dog state. You perfect a good heart, or you make a good heart. So your habit is a good heart. So when you die, you will go to a good destination because of that, right? But the point is that something may happen at the moment you die that makes you very angry at the moment you die, for example. So because you get very, very angry at the moment you die, maybe somebody kills you, for example, and you get very angry with them because they're doing something very bad. And that anger can then take you to a bad rebirth because of that. You see? So that is why it's a bit like throwing up a stick, because there's so many things which happen around the moment of death that you can't really control. So it depends on what happens at that moment. Yes, but it's just like your mind in daily life, you know. It goes up and down, right, in various states. And some of those states will be like, high rebirth states, other ones will be low rebirth states. So it depends on which of those states you have when you die, largely here. But because death is often the time when you are, relaxed and you are peaceful because you haven't let go of the world, very often it is the habitual karma which will come into action there. Most of the time it is the habitual karma. So if you do good habitually, if you are a good person habitually, usually it will go to a good destination. But it is quite, in one way it's quite frightening, this idea of a stick. It's sort of because you don't really know what's happening here. Well, it's not really a chance, it's just that the conditions are so complex, you can't really tell beforehand what's going to happen there. It's very, very complicated there. That's really the reason there. But the other thing is that if you then are so unlucky to get reborn in a bad state because of a bad mental state when you die, usually if you habitually have done a lot of good, it won't last all that long here, right? There are stories in the suttas of somebody who did one bad act, and that bad act led to their rebirth, and they went to a bad destination for a few days, and then they got reborn in heaven afterwards. And so, it is always an immense advantage in doing good acts, obviously, here. Okay, so, and then you can see here that these sort of actions, which are both hurtful and kind, they lead to rebirth in the human realm. So human realm is a place where you have to expect both the unpleasant and the pleasant. You can't get away from it. It's basically what it says here. Mingled pleasure and pain. Don't go looking for this pleasure, because you're not going to find it in this realm. And also some gods, some of the lower gods, even though they have more pleasure than us as humans, they still have some affliction as well and some pain as well. There's a mixture of pain and pleasure, even for the lower gods. And some of the lower beings which are meant here is the animal realm and also the ghost realm. Both the animal realm and the ghost realm have both painful and also pleasant feelings to them. It's funny when you, sometimes when I eat in my QT, which is quite often actually, then I give some of the leftover food to the kangaroos afterwards. And they're really, really keen on human food. You can see the eyes lighting up. And they're so happy. You know, you give them a piece of cake or something, they become really, really excited. So obviously there is some pleasure there, even for animals, obviously. And the pleasures are actually very similar to the human pleasures, which is also very interesting. You can imagine when you eat grass all day and a little bit of cake is very exciting. Okay, so now we come to the last type of action that the Buddha talks about here. And what puna is action that is neither dark nor bright, with neither dark nor bright result, action that leads to the destruction of action. Therein, the intention for abandoning the kind of action that is dark with dark results, the intention for abandoning the kind of action that is bright with bright result, and the intention for abandoning the kind of action that is dark and bright with dark and bright result. This is called action that is neither dark nor bright with neither dark nor bright result. Action that leads to the destruction of action. Okay, now this is a different type of action altogether here. And this is, the point of this is, as I understand it, is simply that, and it's very, I think it's reasonably obvious, is that you want to abandon all action, because action leads to rebirth. So you want to abandon all the causes of rebirth. So you want to abandon action completely here. So by abandoning action, you are abandoning samsara, you're abandoning suffering, you're putting everything behind you. And that's why you want to abandon action here. And this particular intention for abandoning all action, I think it is an intention which is very difficult to have if you're just for ordinary people, putujanas. It's very difficult because you really have to see the suffering of samsara. You have to see the problem and you have to have this desire to get out of the problem to really be able to have this intention fully. You can have it partially maybe because you see that there is suffering around. But to have this fully, you really have to be a sotapanna or even a higher stage of enlightenment. And so this is the typical intention that the sotapanna will have, or the once-returner or the non-returner has. The intention to destroy all action so that you can actually come to the end of samsara and the end of this whole process of rebirth. For mere mortals, there's always going to be an attraction there in getting reborn in a heavenly state where there's lots of pleasure. That attraction is always going to be there until you fully understand that even that state is not really satisfactory. Okay, so those are the four types of action. These are the four kinds of action proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. And that is essentially the content of the sutta. The last page, which comes now, is a standard passage. It's a type of passage which you see again and again and again in the suttas. And again, I would say it doesn't have much, all that much historical value, because you don't really know. It's very unlikely that exactly this same thing was said in every sutta with different people. In fact, it's completely unlikely. So this should be considered more like the standard ending of the sutta, which may have been said once or twice, but not likely in this particular situation. But still, it's interesting. So we'll just go through it. When this was said, Punna, son of the Kalyans, the ox-duty ascetic, said to the Blessed One, Magnificent Venerable Sir, the Blessed One has made the Dhamma clear in many ways. From today, let the Blessed One remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. But Senya, the naked dog-duty ascetic, said to the Blessed One, Magnificent Venerable Sir, the Blessed One has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to the Blessed One for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. I would receive the going forth under the Blessed One. I would receive the full admission. So I think the main meaning here is pretty obvious. You turn upright what was overturned. You reveal the hidden. Obviously, he reveals the truth. Showing the way to one who was lost is obviously very clear. Certainly, you know what to do. But the last one is a bit interesting here. Holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. This one is a little bit more ambiguous and difficult to understand what is meant by this one. And the point here, the idea of those with eyesight, which seems a bit strange, the point here is that you can teach the Dhamma to many different types of people. And some people will be very deluded. Some people will actually not understand it, even if you teach it. And those are the ones who haven't got eyesight. And you know that in the suttas, sometimes you talk about people with lots of dust in their eyes. And those people who have a lot of dust in their eyes, they are the ones who don't have eyesight. So even though you hold the lamp up, you won't be able to see. And this is the point here. The lamp is obviously the Dhamma. But because you are too deluded and too far away from the Dhamma, you still can't see it. So, then he asked to become a monk. And then the Buddha says, Senya, one who formerly belonged to another sect and desires the going forth and the full admission in this Dhamma and discipline lives on probation for 4 months. At the end of 4 months, if the bhikkhus are satisfied with him, they give him the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhus state. But I recognize individual differences in this matter. That means, apparently, that if the Buddha thinks that he should be ordained sooner, then the Buddha will ordain him sooner. Venerable Sir, if those who formerly belong to another sect and desire the going forth and the full admission in this Dhamma and discipline live on probation for 4 months, and if at the end of 4 months the bhikkhus being satisfied with them give them the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhu state, then I will live on probation for 4 years, showing his enthusiasm here for the Dhamma. At the end of the 4 years, if the bhikkhus are satisfied with me, let them give me the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhu state. Then Senya, the naked dog-duty ascetic, received the going forth under the Blessed One, and he received the full admission. And soon, not long after his full admission, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Senya, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And the Venerable Senya became one of the Arahants. There's a few more things I just want to point out in this last paragraph here, which is interesting. And the first one is to note here how this monk is actually dwelling to be able to become an Arahant. So this shows you a little bit about what is required. And the first thing that is required here was he dwells alone and withdrawn. So this basically means that you find a place completely by yourself, secluded from people, secluded from society at large, staying by yourself in the kuti. This is the first requirement for becoming an Arahant. And the Buddha said, it is impossible to enter the deep jhanas unless you enjoy solitude. You have to enjoy solitude to be able to enter jhanas. And of course, jhanas are the precursors to full enlightenment. And the second factor required here is you have to be diligent, ardent, and resolute. In other words, you have to put forth effort. So you have to be secluded, and you have to put forth effort. And if you do those two things, and you do it in the right way, then this is what happens. You become an arahant. And the second thing here, which is probably worth mentioning, is the very last part here, where he says that he directly knew birth is destroyed. And this is interesting, because sometimes people say, well, how can you know that birth has been destroyed? And this is actually the knowledge of the arahant. You can see that craving has been taken away. You know that craving leads to rebirth. So by inference, you know there cannot be any more rebirth because craving is gone. So the arahant actually knows that there is no more rebirth. And you can ask somebody, do you know that there is no more rebirth? You can ask them that if you like, and if they say, yes, I know there's no more rebirth for me, then they would be an arahant. So that is a knowledge of the arahant. He actually has to know, he or she has to know, that there is no more rebirth in the future. Okay, that's it. Any questions, anybody? Anything? Yes, sir. Okay, direct knowledge means that you are experiencing it for yourself. Okay, it's not something you hear from somebody else, but you know it in your own heart. That is direct knowledge. So, and that is the point I was mentioning before, that the Buddha, when it came to things like rebirth and karma, and also full enlightenment, all of those things he knew with direct knowledge. So he knew it in his own heart. It wasn't anything that came from anybody else. Yeah. Yes? Number 11. Yeah. Okay. What is it that you don't understand there, so to speak? No. What it means is that you practice the Eightfold Path. And you know, because you know that the Eightfold Path will eventually lead to complete cessation, complete ending of actions, right? So it's the Eightfold Path. Your intention is to end rebirth. And because your intention is to end rebirth, whatever action you do is based on that intention, right? So each action which leads its intention, it's action with intention that leads to the end of rebirth. Yeah. Well, that's the point. It doesn't. That's the point here. The point here is that the action of somebody who has the intention simply of wanting to stop this whole thing called samsara, if that is your intention fully, 100%, and I say it can only be a sotapanna who can have that sort of action, then that action only has the result of leading to out of samsara, leading to the end of rebirth. Right. Okay, that's a good point, actually. That's useful, isn't it, to have an example of that? I think maybe insight action here. So say that you come out of a deep jhana state and you have a profound insight into reality here. And that profound insight doesn't necessarily lead to any particular state, but it leads out of samsara. So that intention which you have at that point when you see something deeply, that is the intention which leads to the end of action. Yeah, of course. That's very true. So the point is not so much that you have taken away all action of the past. That's not the point here. All the actions that you have done in the past, they are still there. Right? So if a sotapanna dies as a sotapanna, then depending on past action, he or she will get reborn in different realms. Okay? Because they still have lots of actions accumulated over many, many lifetimes before they became a sotapanna. Those actions will then determine where they get reborn. And I think it's also true to say that even if you're a sotapanna, it doesn't mean that all your actions go towards the ending of rebirth. A sotapanna is still capable of having greed. A sotapanna is still capable of becoming angry and irritated, etc. It's quite possible. And those actions which they do with those sort of mind states will tend to give rise to rebirth, in various kind of realms. But the general intention which they have when they practice towards enlightenment is the intention not to get reborn anywhere. They don't have that intention anymore. The intention at that point is to make an end of everything. Yeah. You have to remember that it's difficult to have this sort of intention that you want to get rid of everything, you know? It's not easy, yeah. So it's perfectly okay to have the intention, I'm doing this for a good rebirth. It's fine, it's not a problem. Because the point is really that as a Buddhist, the wonderful thing about this path is that it all leads in the same direction. So if you practice towards a good rebirth, that practice is also leading you towards enlightenment. Because a good rebirth is doing good acts, right? By doing good acts, you're purifying the mind. By purifying the mind, you're enabling yourself in the future to meditate and to have deep insights. So you're doing two things at the same time. You're practicing the path to enlightenment, and you're also practicing the path to a good rebirth. So you don't really have to worry so much about it. The important point is rather that you cannot force yourself to have an intention to end everything. It's impossible to force that sort of thing. This only comes about by thinking about the Dhamma and slowly but surely maturing in your understanding. And then naturally, one day you will think, maybe I don't want to get reborn. Maybe this is just a whole lot of nonsense to get reborn. Maybe actually I want to end this whole thing instead. But you cannot say, yes, okay, I'm going to end this whole thing, if you don't really feel it in your heart. It has to come from the heart. You know. So in the meantime, just do good. And either way, it's going in the right direction here. Okay. The thing about rebirth is that it gives a very powerful incentive to do good actions. Okay, fair enough, you can believe, you can say in this life that sure enough, if you do good, it will make you more happy, etc. It's just a psychological thing. You know that if you do good, it makes you more happy. And so for that reason alone, it's sufficient to be moral. But the point is that if you really believe in rebirth, and you realize the consequences of what you're doing can last for so long, and over so many lives, then the incentive becomes so much more powerful. You see? So suddenly, if the choice is between a heavenly realm or going to a hell realm, for example, then of course the suffering you have as a human is nothing at all compared to what you will have in the hell realm or even the animal realm. It's enormous amounts of suffering. So the importance of this kind of right view is simply that it encourages you so much more to do good things. It gives you a very, very powerful reason if you have some faith that it is true. There is a very nice sutta by the Buddha called the Apanaka Sutta, as Majjhima Nikaya 60. Where the Buddha says that the thing is that if there isn't rebirth, well then by doing good actions, you will feel happiness in this life, and wise people will praise you for being good, right? But if there is rebirth, then you additionally will also experience the happiness of having done good actions in future lives. Now, if you don't believe in rebirth, the problem is that these things are just matters of belief, aren't they? We don't know whether there's rebirth or not. So if you don't believe in rebirth, you also have to accept at the same time that you don't really know. So because you don't know, you say, okay, I'm going to do good actions just in case there is. So the Buddha says that if you don't believe in rebirth or you do believe in rebirth, either way, you're better off because you're happier in this life. And also, you're not taking any chances on what happens after death. Well, this is an important question in Buddhism. What does belief and faith and view mean in Buddhism, right? The point in Buddhism is that a view is never absolute until you become a sotapanna, right? It's only when you're sotapanna and you see for yourself, then the view becomes absolute. Okay, now I know. Before that, it's only a matter of faith, a matter of belief. So many people say, I don't believe in rebirth. But the answer to that is that to say that, well, actually, you don't know. You haven't seen for yourself with absolute certainty that there isn't rebirth. So what you should do is to keep an open mind. Don't cut it off completely. Ask yourself whether, you know, you don't know. So keep an open mind about this. And somebody who is completely confident that there is rebirth, well, they should be more humble about it and realize they don't know that there's rebirth. Okay, you can be completely confident about it, which is good, but also realize that you don't know. And the day might come when you realize this for yourself, which is great. But don't think that you know until you know. So it's faith, and that faith can be 99% or it can be 1%. But it's like, and you are somewhere along that sliding scale. That's where your faith is. So, and it's actually a very important subject, I think, because faith in Buddhism is very different from faith in other religions. The word faith in most religions means I know this is true, right? If somebody says I believe in God, you use the word believe. But if you ask them, well, does that mean that you think maybe there is a God, maybe there isn't a God? Of course, that's what it means. It means I'm absolutely sure that there is a God. So the word, in most religions, the word faith and belief doesn't actually mean faith and belief. It means certainty. But in Buddhism, it is actually real faith and belief. You have faith because you have reason to believe that this is a good way of living. This is the right thing. It can be strong faith. It can be weak faith. But it is just that. It's just faith until you know for yourself. Okay, maybe we should call it a day and pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.